So we're going through Matthew 5 through 7, which is the Sermon on the Mount. And so you could turn to that while we kind of start out kind of our talk this morning. How many of you guys would say that you are a photographer, whether professionally or like, you know, this is something like I'm into photography. Are you in photography professionally or just like in the heart? What's that? In the heart. Okay. So you haven't gotten paid yet. So anyway, Megan, did you put your hand up? Okay. So do you guys have like, you know, the SLR camera and all right. You guys have different lenses that you have for that. Okay. How many of you guys like have a camera that you have like multiple lenses for? Okay. All right. So some of you guys put your hands up. So, what's the most important lens? What's that?
The one that works.
Okay. What's that? That's when you're not a photographer, but you got the equipment though, right? So what do you guys think? You know, even the non-photographers probably can answer this question. You know, Steve, yes, the one that works, right, would be important. And so is there one lens that you would say like you should only have as a photographer? Could you paraphrase?
Wide lens.
A wide lens, okay. Is that something?
That's wide lens. I was going to say okay. Wide lens, but it depends what you're taking pictures of.
It depends on what you're taking pictures of. Okay. So a lens would be good for what?
Landscape.
Okay. And taking in what?
The whole
like wider things, right? All right. So, and then what else is a good lens? What's that?
Telephoto.
Okay. What's that good for?
Zooming in.
Okay. And then, what do you think else is a good lens?
Your eye.
Talking about cameras here. No, I know. So you're all right. That's a good one. That's a good one. We might actually get to that today, actually. You know, so what about just like the standard old regular old lens? How many of you guys take pictures? How many have taken a picture in the last week of anything? It's because we got our phones, right? I remember I got like the first cell phone, like smartphone. I was like, I think I had a smartphone, and then I was like, you know what? I'm not going to get any of that. And then I don't want a camera. I don't want anything. I just want bare bones, basics. And then we had a kid, and I was like, man, I really wish I had a camera. So then got another camera, you know. And then you take thousands of pictures, some that, you know, you're like, we take more pictures than we probably look at. At least the ones that we take. But, you know, if you guys even thought, like, well, sometimes, yeah, I want to, like, zoom in on something. So even with the age of having professional phones in our pockets, that's kind of even, like, where Apple has been going. Like, hey, you have a professional camera, you know, in your pocket. That sometimes it depends on what you are shooting, right? That you'll need a kind of a standard lens, or you want a lens that you can get real close, or you want a lens that kind of you get far back onto. And so if we kind of even think about this idea of like taking pictures, what does a picture show us that we don't know about ourselves? So say you lived in the age where like I was like, no, I don't even want a camera. But like, what do you see? When you look at a picture of yourself, like what are the things that you notice? Okay, your hair is messier than you think it is. More gray in your beard than you think it is, right? You know, this probably could go the same way of like looking in a mirror, right? But I think sometimes with a picture, you know, if you're with other people, what stands out?
Did I really wear that?
Did I really wear that? How could my wife let me wear that? And where is she? So, you know, yeah. How tall you are, right? Again, what you look like, some things like, is that my smile? Like, maybe I need to work on my smile. My smile looks like I've had the same smile since I've been in middle school, you know, with that cheesy portrait. So so the first thing I want us to kind of think about is the lens we use depends on really the picture that we want to take. And so when we're looking at the Sermon on the Mount, there's kind of a couple things is that we can go real zoom in onto these portions of this sermon, but I wanted to kind of zoom out. But it's really not like the wide angle lens, because we would do it in like 1 week and say, hey, this is kind of the big flow. But I do want to kind of capture, so maybe this is kind of like the somewhere wide-ish lens. And it gives us a different perspective on things, right? You can, you know, if you took a picture of a mountain, right? It could be the picture of the mountain, but if you had something that you zoomed in on, you're like, oh, there's an animal on that mountain or somebody on that mountain. And you could get that perspective or pay your attention to that specific detail than the mountain as a whole. And the other thing about the picture is kind of it gives us a reflection of who we are that sometimes we don't see through our own lens. That was mentioned earlier, right? Of our eyes. And so that gives us, that's a helpful window for us. And we might get to that by the end of our lesson. We'll see how far we get with this. So this is the greatest sermon ever preached by Jesus. And again, he's kind of masterfully going through old truths, but I would say kind of in a fresh new way. And it's not necessarily like, you know, so it's not, you know, hey, this is something revolutionary. But in some sense, the traditions that the Jews were used to and the way that they interpreted Scripture, it was almost like, I've never heard it, you know, this way. Because again, Jesus isn't saying anything new, but he is saying things in a way that is convicting the listener. And for us, it's good to kind of stop and kind of think about what are all the things that Jesus is saying. But it's good to have that kind of wide angle lens to kind of see of like, well, why is he going and saying the things that he's saying? That's probably the hardest thing, you know, for me is like, why did he say these things? Because it's easy sometimes to like granularly look at like, you know, certain verses, but like, why does he say it the way that he says it? And so that's what I'm hoping to try to uncover and pull off in some of these passages that we're going to go through. So we finished off on verse 26. We're going to dive into something, you know, kind of a serious topic, right, on verse 27 of chapter 5 in what Jesus is saying. But so far, remember, he kind of starts out with like, hey, these are blessings, right? If you are part of the kingdom, that was his kind of introduction. That was his way to kind of hook the people. And then he says, you know, I didn't come to abolish the law. And remember, he says, starts going through these kind of ideas by saying, you have heard that it was said, you know, but I say to you, and you've heard that it was said either in Scripture or in your tradition, but I'm going to tell you kind of like really what God meant by these things. And it weren't like, oh yeah, I guess he did mean that. It was like, oh yeah, right. I'm kind of like holding God's standard as like just like what he said, but God has an intention in the law that carries an even greater weight that Jesus is using to not only convict the listener, but also to either prove or disprove to the listener whether they truly are a part of the kingdom of God and really following God rightly. So in verse 27, we see one of those others, you have heard that it was said. And again, he uses these kind of verbal rhetorical, phrases that kind of gives this kind of rhythm and pattern as he goes through certain topics. And then we'll see it kind of changes when we get to chapter 6. So you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go to hell. All right, so what's Jesus getting at in verses 27 through 28? Again, there's kind of like, you know, again, if you look at like the heading for the paragraph, you're like, well, this is what he's talking about, right? If you look at the heading for the paragraph of that, what does it say? What's that? So I heard, and you know, those are infallible, right? Those headings, no. So one of them was what? Lust, and I heard adultery, okay, and I don't know if there's something else, but you kind of have a couple things. So in there, so what's you know what's he getting at? What is he? Why is he bringing up this scenario?
I don't know if I'm getting at the point of it, but
It's kind of a deep question that I've spent more time thinking about than probably you have. So, but give it a shot, Troy. I want to hear what you have to say.
So this is what Randy whispered in my ear in case it's wrong.
Maybe you should change.
Like, it seems like the Israelites just had an extremely narrow view of the application of God's law and Jesus coming out saying, "You know, you're going to be saved through faith." The full intent, the full application goes well beyond your very narrow application of a strictly physical act, the thoughts of the heart and the passions and all that.
I want you to high five Randy.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, high five Randy. He's good. He's good. You're going to have to sit separately on the test, though. I want you to do your own work, Troy. So, you know, we kind of said this before. Like, you look at it on the surface, you say, like, you've heard that he said you should not commit adultery. And you're like, check, got that. I haven't committed adultery. And so I'm good there. And so it's one of those Ten Commandments, you know, scenarios that you're like, I've got that covered. Ten Commandments are easy. And again, we talked about that last time, right? Where some people are like, oh, Ten Commandments, I've done those things. And you're like, have you really? You've probably done a few of the commandments, like the easy ones. And the last week, you know, we talked about murder. And so you're like, I haven't murdered. So that's good. And he said, like, well, what do you feel about your brother? Have you ever hated your brother? And you're like, well, that's a technicality, Jesus, right? And so the same thing goes with adultery. Right? And you can look at the statistics as far as like unfaithfulness. And honestly, like when I kind of started looking at that, and I don't really want to pull our attention away too much on that. I mean, it's just kind of shocking, frankly, when you look at, you know, unfaithfulness in marriage and just the statistics as far as like what is shared. And so, you know, where it's a thing where you're like, oh yeah, most people, you know, it doesn't happen. It does happen. But we even go back to Jesus' time. It was probably less likely that adultery happened, but it did. We know that, right? We know there are scenes in Scripture where, you know, Jesus with the woman in the well. It was like, yeah, you're working on, you know, multiple husbands, right? And the guy that you're with isn't even your husband. And so so we know that adultery did happen even in Jesus' day. But for them, it could have been just an easy, like, check the box, you know. And so that's really what Jesus is after, right? You've heard that it was said, but, you know, have you looked at somebody lustfully? And so then what's the difference, right? And even there, like if you start looking at the statistics and say like, well, what is adultery and how do people interpret being unfaithful? There's categories of like unfaithfulness. And so we don't need to go into that. But, you know, you could say like, where is the line when you have been unfaithful? And so Jesus is pulling the line all the way into the back and saying, like, you start to draw your attention elsewhere and you have been unfaithful. So do you want to check that box still? And so that's where he wants to kind of like hit them with the gravity. You've heard it said like this, but let me tell you that. And I don't think anyone would say, well, you know, Jesus, I think you're interpreting the Old Testament wrongly or what God intended. I think the true, you know, emphasis of, right, you know, a man and a woman being together and that's it, doesn't leave room for anything outside of that. And so he kind of sets that up as like the picture, right, of like the standard. And then what does he give for the response? Like what's the response for, you know, if you find yourself like falling into temptation and being unfaithful? Even at like that very start and that standard, what does he say to do? Pluck your eye out, right? Or what else? Cut your hand off. I mean, it's just easy, right? You find yourself, you know, you're causing yourself to stumble. Like, just take care of the physical member that's doing it, right? That'll take care of it. So is that what he is like emphasizing and promoting? No. I mean, if he was, then like all of his disciples would, you know, be like one hand, you know, one eye, you know, disciples. And so, anyway, don't let that picture sink into like, right? But if you stop and think about it, right, the moment of temptation, right, is brief. And so for all the moments, you know, that happen within a year, I can't remember if I got the stats right, if I put it, 31 million seconds in a year, or is it minutes? I might have run the wrong one. But if you kind of think about it, let's say minutes. So 31 million minutes. Someone can do the math real quick. And so just, you know, if you think like that many are in a year, if like pauses of time are like all it takes, right, to stumble, to cause yourself to sin, right, you don't have enough members to do that. And even if you were blind and, handless, right, would that cause you not to sin, right? No, because we know that sin is in the heart. And so he kind of like throws that out there as like this, again, shocking like kind of picture for people to say. But again, if you say that you follow God, right, like God has a high standard. So what does that look like? But what is it? What is the picture that he wants to kind of leave them with, right? Because what's he saying? So pluck your eye out, cut your hand off, because what's the end result? It's not just like you've sinned, and you know, which is should be big enough, right, for the community, and sinned against a person and loving your neighbor and all that. And it's not just you've sinned against God, which is strong enough. Like Jesus really gives the teeth on like, hey, there is something you should be seriously concerned about here. And what is that concern? What's that? Going to hell, right? There is judgment for your actions. There is judgment for the things that you do. And it's almost like he could say, I wish it was as easy as plucking your eye out, which if you thought, like, how hard would that be? Or cutting your hand off. I mean, I don't know if I could go through that, right? I mean, if that's all is easy, but, you know, there'd have to be professionals that did it for you, right? Because Jesus is saying, you go ahead and you take care of it yourself, because there is a greater judgment. As awful as that sounds to you, to remove an eye or remove a hand, like something greater is waiting, right? And so he starts this sermon just like a couple minutes ago saying like, how blessed are you, right? How blessed are you? Those are the, you know, those that are peacemakers, those that are, you know, merciful. And he said, you know, I'm here to just kind of uphold the law, right? We're all on the same page. So let's get to the law. If you want to make this a matter of the law. And now the gravity of this is like sinking in for the people. And so Jesus is laying down conviction, right, for them. That judgment is waiting and you should truly want to escape. And so, you know, again, if we just kind of look at like the sins that he said, you know, like there's issues of anger and issues of lust, right? These are places that you can go to. These are verses you can go to and kind of recalibrate our thinking, right? Counseling with people, like go to these verses and talk to them about this. But again, the big picture is, right, you know, there is judgment. And that is the line that Jesus wants us to kind of understand, right? You're either in the kingdom and you're desiring to do good, and there is blessing and reward that is waiting for you, or you're not in the kingdom, and there is judgment, and you should be seriously concerned about that. Right, right. And I would even think, you know, I mean, you could even apply it. You know, I think especially like young men where like I think in public these things aren't, you know, and I'll say this, young men who are certainly unbelievers, these ideals are not only like, you know, in public you'd say like, well, of course, like these things are wrong. But these things are celebrated, right? You know, really mocking each other and cutting each other down. Like, that's like kind of like just like a commodity amongst, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, certain groups of people, but just knowing like my own experience, like in college, and even knowing like those that, you know, like there are similar experiences, right? That is just kind of like what's the big deal, right? And as Neil said, like there is a huge deal. Not only is it like not should be celebrated, but it should be condemned. And so it's not to take something lightly and one up each other with, but it's also something that has a consequence that God is serious about. And even when you say the thing about worry, right? There's larger implications, and we'll get to that. So I'm glad you kind of pulled that one in as well, even though in the context here, he's kind of talking about a few other areas, right? Because God is concerned. I mean, again, it's not just like, hey, there's a standard, just so you know, right? And if you don't fall into line, right, there's the worry of hell. Like, what is God's concern? What's Jesus' concern? Yeah, and he's a shepherd that's pursuing the sheep. And so he's doing this in a way that's like, I want you to come here. I want you to follow me. I am the bread of life, right? I am eternal water that will, you know, you might be thirsting, but I will provide this for you to fill the need that all these other things don't fill at all. And so... So Jesus' words can speak to a whole host of people, whether it's like it is flippantly celebrated, right? Jesus has words for that, or like, oh no, that's wrong. I checked that box, and then it's like, well, did you? And you're like, oh yeah, okay, I guess maybe I need the subset box I need to check as well. So he continues on, right? Verse 38, he says, you have heard that it was said, again, using that same rhetorical statement, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. So what's this one about? I don't know what the heading is on this one. I don't remember that one. What's that? Retaliation. Okay, so retaliation. What's maybe like the positive side of that coin? You got retaliation, revenge, but really, like if you provide revenge, you're upholding what? Justice, right? So on the surface, it kind of seems like that, right? You know, an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth, or like there's a standard of a law that, you know, you would even say, you know, some point to this and say, well, you know, there are laws that preceded, you know, the Bible and other cultures that had the same eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. So it's kind of almost like a universal standard law. But it's really about not necessarily justice. It's really about a person's understanding of what justice is. In this case, what does justice require? The eye for the eye and tooth for a tooth. What does justice require? What's that? Equal punishment for the crime, right? And we even have, is it one of our amendments, right? That you should, like, cruel and unusual punishment. My kids always say that. Hey, Dad, what's? I think it's like the Fourth Amendment. Dad, what's the Fourth Amendment? I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, it's cruel and unusual punishment. And so for whatever like punishment I'm doing, this probably has to do with cooking or something. And so anyway, it's a funny one at the moment. What's that? Yeah, I know. I'm like, I don't know. What is that one? Ha ha ha. Yes. So they'll miss it on a test though. No, I'm just kidding. Hopefully not. But there, you know, we have that as like this idea that, right, so justice, the punishment should fit the crime, right? And if it's over and above, there's this idea like, well, that's not right. That's not fair. But what does justice require, right? I want you to go back to Genesis 4. Remember we opened up that kind of window when we looked at the idea of anger? Right, we kind of said like, where, you know, why is Jesus talking about taking somebody to court, you know, and when you make an offer to God, Like, make sure that you go to your brother first, you know. I mean, again, there is application for that, and there's application for us, for them as Jews, as they would go to the synagogue or go to the temple. There's application for us as we go to church, as people get brought to our mind. You know, I probably should be made right before that person. But again, it kind of pulls back to, like, that whole, this whole story, right? This whole issue between Cain and Abel, right? That that anger was something that preceded even this idea of worship. And God, right, knows. And anyway, so we don't have to rehash that. But let's continue on, because we stopped at verse 12. But verse 13 says, and this is where I felt like I always kind of messed up teaching Genesis 4. It just never sat right with me. I just always felt like, anyway, we'll go over that. I'll explain. Right? Go back to Genesis 4. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." So what was his punishment? Yeah, he was banished, right? He kills his brother, and God says, "Oh, you're banished." All right? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What should happen to Cain? Right? He should die. It should be his blood for shedding the blood of his brother. And so God doesn't even do that, right? And so in this first instance, he goes easy on him. He says, "You're going to be banished."
He even guarantees
that no one will take your blood. Exactly. You're right, because that's what he says, right? He says, "My punishment is greater than I can bear." Like, oh, banishment. You know, "Behold, you've driven me today from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so," right? This is what Randy was referring to. "If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him." Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And so like for I don't know, for me, I was like, he got off, right? God went easy on him. So like, what's the message, God? Like, you can kill your brother and then just, you know, get off a little bit easier, right? So there's more that we could go into, and I don't want to like kind of teach this passage, but really what's the you know, what happened with Cain? What did God provide for Cain? What's that? He provided protection for him, right? He really was this act of mercy that he gave Cain. He warned Cain, and Cain went against what God's warning and killed his brother. And then God said, you know what? Not only like, you know, will no one kill you, there'll be a mark. And I'll then enact vengeance on that person. Like, I almost have your back, Cain, in this situation. And so what do we pull away from this?
God is merciful and gracious.
So God is merciful and gracious, okay? What is this, you know, what is this, when we say our own standard of how we should judge others, what does this, you know, where does this allow us to sit? How many, okay, let's say this. In what situations are we a judge over others?
Parent-child.
What's that?
Parent-child.
Okay. So parent-child. In those situations, the parent, do you guys always make the right decisions?
Yes.
Of course, I know. And sometimes you're like, were we too harsh? Or, you know.
Listen to this later, I just have to get that in.
What'd you say?
Yes,
yeah, yeah. We'll make sure the camera. And so there's a tendency for us to think like, you know, to judge rightly. And it is easy, like, let's just make a universal standard, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. That's like an easy judgment, right? It's an easy judgment. But, you know, a good judge really gets into the context. And even if the judge has the authority, let the judge be the authority, right? And I think that's sometimes hard for us. When we are parents, we step into that role of authority, right? And we understand, like, we're not always going to get it right. Is this going to make them a fruitful citizen? Is this going to like lead them to God when they're, you know, 20 years from now? I don't know. I mean, they're all so small microcosms, but that's kind of the role that God puts us in. But when it comes to like being judge over people like our peers or our coworkers or whatever, like we want to sit in that seat of judgment, right? Because we can make our own thoughts about like, man, they really shouldn't have done that, or I did a better job than that person, or, you know, we tend to like want to judge. And then when somebody who is in a true authority, maybe like our boss or something, like does something, then we want to like critique the judge. And really what Genesis 4 should teach us is just like, let God be judge. Because I said, I've taught through this a couple times and I felt like it just never, like I just never could like walk away and be like, yeah, so that's the message for you kids. But really the message is like God made that judgment for Cain, and that was the perfect judgment that he felt for Cain, and just let it go. If I don't agree with it, I'm not the one who makes the decisions. Is this a paradigm for every other decision? No. This is a specific decision, you know, early on in history that God made for Cain. It does show his mercy. It does show his kindness. And that's one side of, you know, of God. But God also says, I am a God who has a huge standard, and Jesus is pointing that out, right? That you slip a little bit, right? That hell is waiting for you. Right? Because whether you sin big or sin small, right? We all know that we've fallen short of God's standard, and it is up to God to deliver mercy how he wants to deliver it, or it's up to God to judge how he wants to judge, right? Paul would pick that up when he talks about the potter and the clay and all of that. So let the judge be the judge. I mean, how would our society look if we just let the people that were in charge make the decisions, and we just like we're okay with that? What's the thing that we tell our kids, right, when we like hand out a judgment on them or a punishment or a consequence? Does anyone have that little phrase that they say?
It's for your own good.
What's that?
It's for your own good.
It's for your own good. That is one. You guys ever heard of the "you get what you get" and "don't pitch a fit," right? Anyone ever heard that? You know, that always works, right? You know, don't pitch a fit, and you're like, okay, right? I mean, you know, you train your children, and we have to train ourselves, like, that's just what happens. I mean, I was at this competition with these kids yesterday, and I videotaped the whole thing, and this one kid got disqualified for his robotics thing, and so his robot hit another robot, and the guy was like, sorry, you're disqualified, and gave him a, didn't get the win on that one. And I went back in the video, I was like, he never even hit him. And actually, if you look, like, he missed the guy going after something else, and the guy came and hit him. And I just said, you know, that just happens, right? They don't do instant replay, and they don't want every like parent or coach being like, here, I got this on your phone, you know, because they're trying to run this competition with 50 different matches. And so I get it. And you just have to say, like, you know what? He made a choice, you know, he made a decision. It was the wrong decision. We can look at that, and you can just learn from it and just say, hey, you know, that's what happens in life. And I can probably point to every year that there's something like that happens, right? Because it happens. Right? I mean, we think like in the world of instant replay and cameras, like every official is going to get it right, but there's none of that in our own lives. And so we know that people above us will make poor decisions. We just have to go along with it. Leaders in our country will make poor decisions, surprisingly, but they were elected. They should know what to do. And so, you know, we can voice our opinions, we can voice our feedback, but if a judgment is laid down, right, then, you know, we just have to accept it on those terms. And there might be times that we can go against that in the parameters that God has out for us. But, man, things would look a lot different. It'd be a lot less gossip in the world if we just accepted things on their own terms. And so, even that, if we just kind of said, like, I mean, if you thought, what is the greatest injustice? You know, if I said biblically speaking, what's the greatest injustice?
Death of Christ.
Right, Jesus, right, death on the cross. And what was Jesus' words on the cross?
Forgive them.
Forgive them because what? They don't know what they're doing. right? Like, I just want to point out, I am sinless, right? These guys, they got it wrong. You know, they weren't there. That, you know, Jesus said, forgive them. Because he knew, one, he was, you know, supposed to end up on that cross. But in the way he ended up, it was a huge injustice. And so, anyway, and so we see that for Christ and how he responded, what more so for us? And so again, you look at that and you say, like, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, and, you know, if somebody puts their cheek, you should turn your cheek and slap, you know, let them slap the other one. And there's, again, good cultural reasons for that, but just standing back is just, you know, there are some situations that those in authority, you just let them be in authority and convict them by the life you lead and the words you say. And Jesus will go a lot more in detail, and the other epistle writers will go a lot more detail on that as well. All right, verse 43, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. All right, so for the listener, what would they think, you know, who would they think their neighbor is? So again, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount to disciples and probably a crowd that's gathered around. Who would be their neighbor? All right, so the fellow Jews, right? Now, who would be their enemies?
Anyone else.
Okay, anyone else, right? And specifically, who's their enemy? Like
the Romans.
The Romans, yeah, specifically, right? Because they're the ones who are, you know, oppressing them, right? Who rule over them. And so this, again, comes to the question of, like, where do we draw that line, though, right? It's sometimes easy to say, like, oh, that person's my friend, that person's my enemy. You know, at what point does a friend become an enemy? Where would you draw that line between two people? What would a Pharisee see about a Sadducee? Right? We already know that they're kind of political adversaries, right? They kind of think differently about Scripture, and they think, you know, they have different places of prominence within the society. Would a Pharisee see a Sadducee as his neighbor? Or would he see him as his enemy? I bet there's probably cases where it was both. When it was against Jesus, right, we saw they kind of allied themselves together. When Paul just mentions, you know, in front of the Sanhedrin, which was made up of both the resurrection, they went at each other and started arguing each other and almost tearing each other apart, right? Enemies at that moment. And so, What does verse 44 indicate? What response does this indicate? Right.
It was definitely being, as Jesus said, it was definitely being said, but it was not being said in the Old Testament. That was an add-on.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, we would agree with that in some sense. Like, it just seems like, you know, it's easy to love your neighbor and your enemy. Who's your enemy? How do you define your enemy? Oh, it's the people that we fight against, you know. And so you kind of, again, have separated them into two camps, right? And so it's almost kind of like, you know, what Jesus is trying to, like, provoke is this sense, like, that you are right and they are wrong. And so because, you know, we feel like we're right and they're wrong, that our response is that we should pray for them, right? If we understand that it's not a you are right or you are wrong situation, kind of even going back to this idea of judgment, that really under God, God will make a decision, right, who is his and who is not his. If we feel, though, that we end up in kind of that situation, what does Jesus say that we should do?
Love our enemies and pray for them.
Yeah. Love them and pray for them. And that really should be our response for everyone. But it seems like almost for the neighbor, like, oh yeah, that was just a given, right? It's just like love and pray for them. But we don't typically tend to pray for our neighbor because like they're in the same boat with us. But for our enemy, you love them and pray for them. It would be no different, right? So he's kind of separated these two groups into people, but it's really, again, like no matter what, we should love the people and pray for the people. It's our enemy, though, that tends to provoke our prayers, right? Because that's usually where we go first, right? Lord, help them see like I see, right? help them, to understand like you've helped me to understand. But the love part is the harder part. And those two things go hand in hand. And again, how Jesus, handled that on the cross and just said, forgive them. They don't know what they are doing. And so again, so Jesus kind of, as he's going, he's kind of then really like turning the screws and convicting them within, their context. Hopefully like as they're thinking like it's kind of upending, what they have thought about how they're living and who their neighbor is and who their enemy is and all of that. And again, Jesus would expand those things as he continues to go along. And then he switches, as he goes to kind of chapter 6, kind of his rhetorical method. And so, because what does that leave you to kind of like, where does this kind of leave you, right? If Jesus stopped his sermon here, like you've heard it was said, but I say to you, where does this kind of leave you sitting and thinking and wondering? If Jesus said like, all right, call it a day, you guys go back to your villages. Like, what do you think is missing?
We don't
What's that?
We don't measure up.
So we don't measure up, and that's clear, right?
Well, I think that's his point.
It is his point. It is his point. And so we don't measure up. So I'll just say, so where Jesus then goes next is if you left like, well, I don't measure up. It's a good place to be and to kind of rethink, am I truly following God? And he goes to the next step and he says, well, let me kind of paint you a picture of what it looks like, right? He's like, I want you to kind of think about like all of these things, these kind of things taken care of like the Ten Commandments and this idea of justice and the things that you've done as far as like loving your neighbor. But now let's go to like kind of like your ongoing practices, even in your daily like life and even in your spiritual life. And let me kind of recalibrate some of those things. We've kind of like got the big like directional, like you're either like going in the right way or you're going in the wrong way. But like, let me point you, like, if you think you're going in the right way, like, let me kind of redefine and refine kind of your thinking about some of these things. And so he's going to start talking about some ongoing practices. And he'll use kind of the rhetorical nature of, he says, like, when, right, so when indicates what? Like, so if I said, when you are doing this, what's that indicate? Some type of action in that you probably should be doing this, right? So when you are doing this, you must, and then kind of gives like a, like this is how you should act, or this is how you should think. Or don't do that, right? When you are doing this, this is wrong thinking. And so he'll kind of start to kind of paint this picture, even within the religious groups. And again, remember, Jesus is talking to a lot of people who think differently about different things. You know, we kind of went through some of those groups, and so he's kind of hitting, you know, all aspects of his audience, which were even there a part of his own disciples. And so verse 1 in chapter 6, he says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. For then you'll have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you that they have received their reward. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you." So for the culture that he's talking about, right, so he says this idea of practicing what before other people? Your righteousness. It's kind of like a weird phrase, right? Like how have you been practicing your righteousness today? And so he kind of phrases in that way of like, you know, when you're practicing your righteousness, because he said, you know, earlier on, right, you must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. In other words, like, you must be righteous as God is righteous. So when you're practicing your righteousness before other people, right, if you do it in order for them to see you, then you'll have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. So he kind of plays upon this idea of being seen and being rewarded. And this idea of reward, we'll talk about a little bit more in depth in just a second. But what's that connection, right? What's the connection of like being seen and getting a reward? How does that play out in kind of the everyday life of the person who's hearing this? We would even say like even our own life. Like where does the importance of being seen in connection with the things that we do connect with some sort of reward? And that idea of reward also can be a wage or a payment for something. Who we're seeking that reward from, right? That's important. Right. What's the idea about a reward? If you even think about like a reward poster, right? What's the whole thing about a reward poster? Of like, you know, you get something, and why? I mean, what if there was no reward and it was like no? Okay, so it's like this incentive, right, to do something. And just like Glenn was saying, right, if you want the incentive, you got to kind of know who's getting it, if there is some sort of reward to be given. And so this idea about being seen or being heard, right, if somebody came in and was like, you know, I don't know, if I went home and, you know, the house was cleaned, not that it isn't right now, but let's just say that it wasn't. Hypothetically speaking, right? It's always clean. Ready for you to come drop in. So I go in. I was like, my wife would be cringing at me for saying that. So if I went in, the house was clean, right? And I was like, wow, who did this? You know, how hard would it be for one of your kids, like let's say one of your kids did it, you know, to just like be silent about it? I mean, that's like kind of like the behavior that we encourage, right? Just do things without a reward just because it's like the good thing to do, right? But we know that in our society, there's this idea about payment. There's this idea about incentivizing, this idea about reward. And so so Jesus kind of plays up on that, because it would have been the same thing in that time as well, right? To get a reward, to get a payment, to get a wage for something that's being done. But it's almost even like thrown out there as like, you know, well, you shouldn't do something for a reward. But does Jesus like discount the whole idea of rewards altogether? No. No. And so we'll look at some of those a little bit later. But, you know, from a Christian perspective, you know, how important is reward? Where have you seen, where do you guys know about the idea about reward in terms of like scripture or of like some sort of incentive?
Heavenly rewards.
Heavenly rewards. Okay. And what's the idea about heavenly rewards? What's it in connection with? Okay. Right. There's an inheritance, right? That is awaiting for us all who are, you know, children of God. But even beyond that, right, there's this idea that the things that we do, our works will be either burnt up. In 1 Corinthians, he says that, or there will be reward for the things that remain. And so kind of we see that idea because, you know, when Paul would say in Ephesians 6, right, bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and in trembling, with a sincere heart as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, right? There's right there kind of baked in, like you shouldn't do anything for the sake of like pleasing man. You should do the sake for pleasing God. Right? So it almost like kind of this whole idea about like a reward system, because if you're doing it to please man, you're just trying to get something from them, like a promotion or, you know, want them to like you or whatever. But the whole idea about a payment or wage and a reward is not something like that God condemns, because he uses that, right, for those that, again, will be with him in heaven. Revelation 11:18, the nations raged, but your wrath came, and the time for the dead to be judged, and for rewarding your servants, the prophets and the saints, and those who fear your name, both small and great, and for destroying the destroyers of the earth. 1 Corinthians 3:14, I mentioned that. If the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. And there's other places in Scripture that we could go on to kind of fill this idea out. But, you know, this idea of a reward is something that, you know, Jesus says is not wrong. But what's the takeaway that Jesus is concerned with? And really, and our actions, just like, you know, let God judge rightly, let God reward rightly as well. And so the righteousness that we do, right, should just be a matter of pleasing God and should be a matter between us and God and not for other people. And we'll look at that. We'll expand that out a little bit because he then goes into some details on specifics of like when you pray or when you fast. And so we'll look at some of those things just kind of briefly as we continue this sermon that Jesus has delivered. So again, he's kind of started with the blessing, going with the conviction and the judgment that is coming. And then he's starting to offer some understanding about what it looks like in your daily practice to live before a holy and righteous God. All right, any questions or thoughts before as we wrap this up for this morning?